You are listening to a sermon by Michael Thomas, recorded on Sunday, February 26, 2012, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
As I was trying to begin to prepare for this morning, I was reminded it's not just Carl who finds Lent a confusing and somewhat bewildering time. As I was looking over the text for this morning, it strikes me that these kinds of themes that we deal with in this season are not the kind of themes that you will typically find in the inspirational section of Christian bookstores. Times of longing, times of desperation, times of sorrow are things which, within our present experience of Christianity, are most people would just as soon ignore. So what do we do with the fact that we have an entire season devoted to remembering that we are but dust? To remembering that we are walking with Christ on the way up to the cross? As I was trying to prepare the text this morning, what I noticed was a very interesting thing that I'd never seen before, that all of the texts had to do in some way or other with baptism. Now for me, baptism and the kind of penitence or the kind of remembering of sorrow that happens in Lent are two very different things. Baptism is a time of celebration, a time of initiation, a time to be reminded that we are clean, that we have been redeemed. And yet, as I was reading through all of these texts, I was struck that perhaps the reason I'd never made this connection before was because my idea of baptism was far too small. That when Christ talks about baptism in the Bible in general, discusses what this means, it had something far bigger in mind than I had for myself. And so today, we're going to look at Lent through the lens of baptism. This requires, first of all, that we look at what is Lent. And second, what is baptism? Now, unlike Carl, I had the opposite problem growing up, really. And that was that I knew the stories about Jesus, which provided the basis for Lent, but I had no idea what Lent was. Once I got to college and heard people talking about this, then I thought they were referencing the stuff that comes out of the dryer, and I was a bit confused. And then once I started finding out a bit more about Lent, it still seemed to me like some sort of baptized diet program. There were two girls on my sister floor in my dorm in Seattle Pacific University who decided to give up carbohydrates for Lent with the goal of losing 5 pounds by the time Easter came around. The most common thing to give up or to hear commended was giving up chocolate, which I think is a fine thing to do to remember that you are indeed mortal. But as much as you might feel like dying after 40 days without chocolate, I still didn't quite directly see the connection with Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. It was not until a few years into my undergraduate studies that I was really shown what was behind this season of longing that the church remembers and celebrates. And that specifically on Ash Wednesday, which happened 5 days ago, I think five, something like that, earlier this week, then we put ashes on our heads to remember that we are but dust. To remember that even though, in one sense, the victory is ours, that Christ has already won it on the cross and at Easter, in another sense, we are still on a journey. We have still not come to that place. We have still not realized that hope which is to be ours. Traditionally, this 40 days leading up to Easter is meant to commemorate Jesus' time of temptation in the desert, as was discussed in the gospel passage that we saw today. And to remember that as Jesus, in his life on earth, made himself nothing and experienced our weakness, so too we who are baptized into Christ must follow him in the road of pain as well as in the road of glory. And so during this 40 days of Lent, we commemorate and we remember both the not yet as well as the to be realized hope. Then secondly, what is baptism? Now this is more dangerous for me, I think, because baptism, I thought I knew what it was. Lent, I could quite honestly say I had no idea. Now my experience with baptism was that it was a public declaration of faith. It was something you did to show that you had decided to follow Jesus and no turning back, no turning back. Which was a great thing and is very true. However, I think I had too small a vision of baptism, because it was, as a public declaration, something that had very little meaning beyond the moment. It was something to declare that I had been redeemed, I had been forgiven, and therefore I was free to go on my merry way, and should I choose to, I could do it again, and again, and as many times as I felt the need. This was indeed baptism as testimony, recognizing what I was saved from. However, in the confessional traditions, baptism serves a very different purpose. An infant is baptized shortly after birth in order to commemorate not only initiation into the church, but also initiation into citizenship. And such, in the Middle Ages, one's baptism was a mark of loyalty to an earthly sovereign, at least as much as a heavenly king. Now this also, I think, hits at an important point that is within baptism, that when we are baptized, we are initiated into a body. It is a beginning as well as an end. However, I think that looking historically, the experience of the early Anabaptists actually provides a much fuller picture of what baptism is meant to be in a scriptural context. Certainly, it was a public declaration of faith. It was a recognition that we are freed from sin. Certainly as well, it was an initiation into a new hope and a new assembly. But it was also something more. It was the recognition that the people of God, when they are baptized, are not simply baptized from their sin, but they are baptized for a purpose. To be called out, to be different, to be a peculiar people, the people of God. And not only that, they are reminded, and we are reminded most powerfully in this season of Lent, that baptism is not an escape from suffering. That baptism is in many ways a way through the wilderness. Historian Justo Gonzalez notes that it is probable that in the early Reformation period, more Anabaptist martyrs died than in the entire first 3 centuries of Christianity. And also notes that, with cruel irony, many of them were condemned to death by drowning, experiencing a third baptism, as it were. Now, for the Anabaptists who accepted this charge, knowing what very well lay ahead of them, and for a leader in the early Anabaptist church, then I think life expectancy was something under 18 months, they could not lightly take this charge. Now we being separated from the conditions of that time, I think often have the luxury of forgetting the difficulty and the longing that comes with baptism. And so this helps explain, I think, a little what Jesus talks about in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, verses 36 through 39. This is the passage where James and John come to Jesus and ask him to sit at his right and his left hand when he comes in glory. And Jesus asks them what I always found an odd question. He says, "Can you drink the cup that I drink, or can you be baptized with the baptism by which I am baptized?" Now, I think the disciples probably didn't understand any more than I did. And they're like, "Well, yeah, I can get wet. Go for it." And so they answer, "Yes, Lord." And yet, what Jesus is inviting us to is far more than a single experience, but rather the whole package that comes with it. So, looking at the passages that we have today, we see that baptism involves not one, but I think really four components. As I experienced and testified with my baptism, we were baptized from sin and death. It is a mark of forgiveness, and it is a mark of new freedom. However, we are also baptized through pain and sorrow. To follow Jesus means to take up the cross as well as to receive the crown. We are baptized for a purpose. Those who have decided to follow Christ no longer own themselves, and so once their baptism is in fact their commissioning. And finally, they are baptized to a heavenly citizenship and to a hope and longing that is the fulfillment of this journey. So looking at our lectionary texts, in 1 Peter 3:18, verses 18 through 22, we see emphasized what we are baptized out of. In verse 18, St. Peter notes, "Christ also died for our sins once for all. He, the just, suffered for the unjust to bring us to God." We see here, baptism is claiming that power of his death for ourselves. If a sacrament is an outward and visible symbol of an inward and spiritual grace, as has commonly been defined, then in our baptism, we recognize that we are no longer living as individuals, but rather we are living within the hope of Christ. And so, the glory and the power that is Christ is also ours. Verse 19, he says, "In the body he was put to death." Now, St. Peter goes over this very quickly, but as we are reminded elsewhere in Scripture, "he was put to death" is more than a passing sentence. That the kind of death that Jesus endured was not something that would be easily passed off. In remembering this, St. Peter reminds us that Christ was crucified, and that those who would be Christians, literally little Christs, must be willing to follow him on that path should he call them. Then we note that St. Peter talks about when he was baptized, he went and ministered to the Spirit. He went and ministered to the spirits. Now, what's interesting about this is the question, why did Jesus have to die? Was there another way? I'm not a great theologian by any stretch of the imagination. But what it appears to me is that in becoming like us, then Christ enabled us to become like him. And so, in dying, Jesus was able to reach out to those who were dead, both those who are literally dead, the spirits that St. Peter talks about, as well as those who were dead in our sins and our transgressions. Finally, St. Peter notes the hope at the end of this journey, that he was glorified with the angels, that he was in heaven at the right hand of God, with all authorities and powers made subject to him. Now, since it is Lent, and since I think that this is the aspect of baptism which is least emphasized within the church, I think Psalm 25 does an excellent job of just exploring some of the desert, or some of the experience of the what we are baptized through. It is important to note, of course, that the psalmist comes to God already having faith. And that the psalmist, although living before the time of Christ, was in some sense baptized into the people of God. And yet the psalmist's experience here is far from what you would expect from the victorious Christian life or your best life now. He begins with the statement, "I will lift up my soul." Now, literally that's, "I will lift up my heart." And what was interesting to me as I was going through this is that I think that in a lot of Christian songs, we have kind of killed our talking about hearts by overuse. We ask Jesus to come into our heart, and when we talk about lifting up our hearts, I always experience some kind of warm and fuzzy feeling during worship. But the language here is the language of sacrifice. That once someone offers something, then they lift it up to God to show it is no longer theirs, it is His. And so in lifting up his heart, the psalmist has given everything that he possibly can and has offered up himself in all pain and all the suffering that comes with. And yet, the result of this, the immediate result at least, is not a sense of victory. It is not a sense of peace or consolation, but it is shame and confusion. The psalmist cannot see, cannot understand. Now I think that would be the hardest part for me. As at various stages in my life when I've been in these situations, I know that I can endure anything if I know what I'm enduring it for. But what of those times when the paths are obscured? What of those times when we can't see what it is that we are enduring it for? Again, reading through Martyr's Mirror in preparation for this, looking especially at the trial of Conrad Grebel, what would have been hardest for me, I think, wouldn't have necessarily been the fire, but the interrogation beforehand, in which he was repeatedly called an arch heretic, told he was destroying Christ's church, told that because of him, souls would be lost. At least for myself, unless I were absolutely convinced of the right of what I was doing, then that would be the worst part, the confusion of not knowing why and not being sure that in fact I was in the right, that in fact I was suffering for righteousness and not for my own stupidity. Now, in the third verse, the psalmist reminds himself, "No one who trusts in thee is ever put to shame." What the psalmist does here is state a truth which he knows from experience but cannot currently see. No one who trusts in thee is ever put to shame. In the long run, yes, but for the moment, what I feel is shame. No one who trusts in thee is ever put to shame. Thus I must hope, even if I do not now see. In verses 4 and 5, he asks to be guided along unknown paths. "Make me to know your ways, O Lord, and teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of salvation, and for you I wait all day long." Now this seems like just about as good and selfless a prayer as you could possibly ask, and yet the fact that he is asking it and the fact that he is repeatedly asking it shows that it is not at this point being answered. The psalmist, for all his desire to see God's will and to do it, is not able to see what that will is in this moment. Why would God not answer such a selfless prayer? When I was thinking about this, I'm actually in my own life a couple months ago, asking much the same question. You know, why is it, God, that all I want to do is serve you and I can't see how to do that? And the image that came to mind was really working with my dad in a tool shop when I was about 3 years old, or 5 years old, something like that. I was old enough to hold a hammer and that was about it. And, you know, for a while, I was very proud of myself helping dad out with his project. And I would take my hammer and I would hit the board and sometimes even hit a nail, you know. And I was quite confident that this was a joint, you know, this was a joint effort. Dad couldn't do this without my help. But there comes a time where if Dad really wants to get the project done, he has to take me out of the tool shed because I will just get in the way. So it is, I think, with God, that there are many times when I, in my eagerness to help God, just wind up messing things up. And so I have to have a time where I don't see the path, where I don't know what's happening, or else I, in my wisdom, will take the plan and make it something it was never meant to be. Verses 6 and 7 speak of a time of refinement. In times of plenty, it is easy enough to delude ourselves that we are, in some sense, you know, worthy of the grace we receive. I remember when I went down to Mexico with YWAM, I went down thinking that I was a pretty good person. I went down thinking that I had a lot to offer. And it really took a long time of God showing me that that wasn't the case. That deprived me of sleep, deprived me of food, put me in a situation where I'm uncomfortable. I turn crabby, I swear like a sailor, I'm very impatient, and I have very little to commend me by way of virtue. So too, the psalmist in this time is reminded of his own unworthiness. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions, but according to your steadfast love, remember me for your goodness' sake, O Lord. What is interesting is that the psalmist, by being turned from himself and by being given this clear picture of what he is actually like, is pointed back toward the character of God. Then finally, in verses 8 through 10, we see the reminder and the hope, even if it is not yet realized. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in his way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. We cannot know necessarily where the path is leading while we are on it, but what I have seen in my life at least, and from the lives of those who are older and wiser that I have talked to, is that looking back, you can see where the path had led. And so, even if it is not our conscious understanding of how it is that God is directing our paths, nonetheless, we see that God is directing our paths in the way that he chooses. Moving on to the gospel passage, Mark 1, 9 through 15, we really emphasize what baptism is for. Now, Mark is a man of action. And so, unlike the other synoptic gospels, Mark does not linger on the details of the temptation. For him, what is for Matthew and Luke, you know, a chapter or several chapters, is compressed down into the space of a few verses. Jesus is baptized. Immediately, Jesus is led out into the desert. Immediately after that, Jesus begins to proclaim the gospel. Now, what stands out to me here is that what's important to Mark is not so much the details of what happens, but rather the purpose to which it is directed. Mark's gospel, as was noted a few weeks ago, Mark begins very abruptly, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And his purpose is simply to expound that gospel, and he really wants to get to the point. And so while it is necessary for Jesus to be tempted and baptized, and then comforted by the angels, what he really cares about is being able to start that proclamation, that good news. And so, in Mark's account, we see an emphasis that what purpose the gospel, the temptation serves is not so much an end to itself, but rather to be tempered or tested. The Greek word there is perazo, which is the same word that you would use for tempering metal. As I was preparing this, what really came to mind was actually the movie Conan the Barbarian, which I am ashamed to admit that I did see. And the one redeeming thing about the whole movie was there is this scene where they are forging a sword and talking about what was necessary in order that the sword wouldn't break when it was used. And the father who's teaching his son about how to forge swords tells him that you must use both fire and ice to temper a blade, then it will not break. Likewise, you must have both comfort and trial and consolation, and trial to be useful, then you will not break. One without the other leaves us soft and unprepared for the mission for which we're called. Finally, in Genesis 9, 8 through 17, we see what we are baptized into and baptized to. And that is the promise at the end of the storm. A covenant, restored relationship, restored creation, a hope beyond all that we now see. During 40 days and nights on a boat with everything that I've known destroyed, no idea what is to come. It is impossible to hope because I literally have no idea what to hope for. And yet, at the end of this time, we receive not only life, but we receive the restoration of all that was promised. A restoration of creation. A restoration of relationship. The ability to live out the purpose to which we were called. This is why we keep going even in seasons of longing. Because we know that we have something good to long for. So in conclusion, I was talking with my brother earlier who's going through a bit of a difficult time. And he was asking me, is it worth it? Is faith worth it? Now it's a fair question, actually. There was a long time when I somewhat sarcastically called God the divine drug dealer. The one who gets you addicted to faith and then you're stuck, you can't leave, even if you really want to. So we take this time, this Lenten season, to remember it is not easy, and no one ever said that it was going to be. In the words of that great theological treatise, The Princess Bride, life is pain, Highness. Anyone who tells you otherwise is trying to sell you something. But the fact is, there is resurrection at the end of the Via Dolorosa. There is a rainbow at the end of the flood. There is an empty tomb, and there is the hope of glory. It is this hope that we look for, and it is this hope that we are reminded of, even when we cannot see it or experience it in this present moment. Thank you.